Again, good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator today. We are very glad you could join us. We will be providing some instructions as we go along for any first-timers we may have, so you can relax and participate with us. If you need assistance, you may use the hand-raising button on your participants panel, and our associate Lori Weber will try to help you via the chat panel. We are very pleased to introduce one of our EIIP partners today, the Natural Hazards Mitigation Association. Our guests will provide an overview of the organization and their new initiative, the Resilient Neighbors Network. But first, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions or comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program. We are making a recording, which should be available later this afternoon, along with a copy of today's presentation, and the text transcript will be posted early next week. Now, if you're not on a mailing list, you can subscribe from our homepage, and then you will get a notice when these materials are ready, of course, as well as notices of future programs. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce Alessandra Duralaman and Terry Turner. Alessandra is the Executive Director and Founder of NHMA. She is also a Program Specialist in the Gulf Coast with Save the Children USA, working on a resilience initiative around children's needs in emergencies. And she also has a book coming out later this year, Natural Hazards Mitigation, which will be published by CRC Press. And Terry is here to represent Augusta, Georgia, a charter member of the Resilient Neighbors Network. She has served as the Assistant Zoning and Development Administrator of the Augusta-Richmond County Planning Commission for over 13 years and also serves in the capacity of Floodplain Manager and Hazard Mitigation Specialist. Please do check out today's background page for further biographical information and links to related resources. Welcome to you both, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. I now turn the floor over to Alessandra to start us off, please.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us today. As Amy mentioned, I'm Alessandra Duralaman, the Executive Director of the Natural Hazard Mitigation Association, and I'm really happy to be here today to tell you a little bit about NHMA, as well as provide some information about our new initiative, the Resilient Neighbors Network. Typically, when I provide a presentation on NHMA, I take some time to talk about hazard mitigation and what mitigation is and entails. However, I think probably for this audience, you have a general feel. And so the point that I really want to make is that when we at NHMA talk about hazard mitigation, we take a broad, holistic, resiliency-focused view, and we find that our members and the communities that participate with us do the same. One thing that we were always very interested in, which has in part led to the creation of the Resilient Neighbors Network, is the idea of what is it that communities that are very successful at risk reduction, vulnerability reduction, building resiliency, what is it that they have in common? And one thing that they all seem to have in common is that they took this broader picture view, starting from the question of what the community valued, what the community needed, and going beyond simply the types of activities that might be most commonly funded using federal mitigation dollars. And in fact, many of these communities have accomplished amazing things with basically no financial resources. And so I just wanted to provide, you know, some example of some types of hazard mitigation that these communities within the Resilient Neighbors Network, as well as within our membership, are engaging in. And again, these are often longer-term focused, taking into account future conditions and taking that holistic view. And so we would talk about things like land use and zoning, building codes, home elevations, education and outreach, hardening structures, open space preservation, coastal protection, planning, safe rooms, retention and detention, and floodproofing, among others. And many of these communities are also very active in the preparedness sphere as well. And so to take a moment to tell you about the Natural Hazard Mitigation Association, we formed the association in mid-2008 out of the realization that there were a great many wonderful national, local, and regional efforts taking place to promote hazard mitigation, resiliency, risk reduction, and that these initiatives weren't always linked to each other, and there wasn't necessarily a good venue for information sharing and collaboration across the universe of hazard mitigation. And one of the biggest challenges that we face, which is also, I think, one of our biggest strengths, is the fact that individuals who come to hazard mitigation typically do so through a range of background professions. And so there are folks who consider themselves planners who focus on hazard mitigation. There are engineers. There are community activists. There are a wide range of professions, again, many of which within their own associations do have subgroups that focus in on hazard mitigation or disasters and do carry conversations among their members, but it can be challenging to cross those lines. We also find that a lot of individuals who work in the field of hazard mitigation are perhaps naturally most comfortable or familiar with the particular hazards with which they tend to work. And so we haven't always had as much communication across the different hazard specialties either. And it may be that there are very successful risk communication endeavors around seismic safety that could very much inform flood risk communication. And so we at NHMA seek to foster that kind of communication, collaboration among supporters of loss reduction through mitigation. And so to that end, just to take a moment to give you a feel for what we do, we focus heavily on education, sharing of resources and information, and so we try, with the help of our members, to monitor and have somewhat of a feel for the different initiatives that are going on, webinars that are made available, publications, across this really broad universe of fields, groups, et cetera, that are at least somewhat active in the hazard mitigation sphere. And we make that available to our membership as a resource. We also try to foster opportunities for peer-to-peer learning. And, of course, that's where the Resilient Neighbors Network is born out of. But even prior to the creation of the Resilient Neighbors Network, we were seeing very clearly how the opportunity for folks to interact with each other from different communities, different backgrounds, whether it be through the listserv, through our annual workshop, or through many other opportunities, that very often that resulted in the sharing of ideas, knowledge, resources. And as we're faced with a resource-constrained environment where those constraints really seem to just be getting worse, and we're also faced with changes in disaster losses, increasing losses, breaking records with climate and things along those lines, that this collaboration and learning becomes more important. We do a lot of education through presentations and workshops, both at existing venues as well as some that we host. And something that's really emerged, I think, in part as a result of our very grassroots membership, is the opportunity to participate in national policy discussions, and not just as NHMA, but actually the opportunity for us to allow our members to provide direct feedback to several national initiatives, such as the upcoming mitigation framework, which they might otherwise not have had the opportunity to do. I mentioned that our membership is very diverse, and we are open to all who support hazard mitigation. The majority of our membership is within the United States, although we do have some international membership. And our membership right now, in terms of our formal members, is over 200, and in terms of our network, those who interact with us through social media or other mechanisms, is over 1,000. If you want more information, we invite you to visit the website. I don't want to take too much more time on NHMA because I want to make sure I can talk to you about the Resilient Neighbors Network and then let Terry talk to you as well. The last comment is that we do have several active committees, several publications, and all of this information is available on our website, as are proceedings, minutes, and agendas from the International Practitioners Workshop, which I mentioned. We just held our third Practitioners Workshop this year. We do these in partnership with the Natural Hazards Center, and we're able to bring together around 100 folks to have an interactive discussion around this idea of how do we do more with less? How do we undertake successful mitigation in a changing and a resource-constrained environment? Now, on to the Resilient Neighbors Network. Peer-to-peer learning, peer-to-peer networking has been something that has been very important to NHMA from our inception. And really, the idea of setting up this kind of a network is something that we have talked about from day one. And finally, this year, we began to actually organize the network. So the Resilient Neighbors Network right now is a network of 10 communities, all of whom were already very active in resiliency, risk reduction, mitigation efforts. And these 10 communities serve as a pilot group, and they are actually designing the network. One of the challenges that we ran into in looking at how best to build something along these lines was the fact that the folks in these communities are doing so much amazing work and wearing so many hats and so busy that it was difficult for them to find these opportunities for networking. And we wanted to create a network that would be a benefit and not a burden. And so we pulled together these initial communities actually around the question of how do we design Resilient Neighbors Network? What types of communications mechanisms work for you? What level of interaction is comfortable? And some things that came out of that are that we can certainly use social media and the web to share some types of information. We are holding monthly conference calls to provide updates to each other in terms of what the different communities are engaged in, and the communities are then able to provide feedback, advice, request guidance from each other. And there's also a lot of that that happens informally between the communities outside of the formal network, as a result of the relationships that were built. And it's been wonderful to see in just the short amount of time that Resilient Neighbors Network has been in existence, the many ways in which the communities have already been able to help each other, whether it is sharing sample recovery plans or talking about mechanisms they're using, unique and innovative mechanisms, for reaching broad stakeholder groups or even identifying who those stakeholder groups are. So it's been wonderful to watch those communications and the benefits that are already being seen by some of these communities. Now, I mentioned that this is a pilot group. This group is going to expand over the next 3 years to bring in additional communities, and some of those communities may be very advanced in their efforts the way these pilot communities are, and others may be communities which are coming to this because they have a desire to start these types of initiatives locally and are looking for mentoring and partnership opportunities. There is a Resilient Neighbors Network website available through the NHMA website, which can give you some information on these initial communities that are participating in the network. And I want to add as well that we have a wonderful advisory team, which is comprised of leading experts in the field, as well as representatives from several federal agencies that are there to advise and be of assistance to the Resilient Neighbors Network community as need be. And finally, I've used the word community several times, and there are, of course, multiple definitions for community. And what I will say is that the Resilient Neighbors communities, they each define themselves differently. You can see in this map the 10 pilot locations, and you can see what the communities are. Some are cities, some are regions, some are counties, some are focused on partnerships that span different communities. And so we don't have a formal definition for this beyond the geographic area or the types of communities with which these different initiatives are engaged. And our 10 charter communities, you will hear from Terry Turner about the wonderful work that she is doing in Augusta, Georgia. Also, among our pilot communities are the Central Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, Charlotte-Mecklenburg County in North Carolina, Jefferson County in West Virginia, Hillsborough County in Florida, Pasadena in Texas, Tulsa in Oklahoma, the state of Vermont, and Grays Harbor, Washington, which I apologize seems to have gotten cut off of the bottom of this slide. And with that, I would love to pass this over to Terry to give you a feel for just some of the fabulous work that's going on locally that we hope to support.
Good morning. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, you're broadcasting, Terry. Please go ahead.
Super. Again, my name is Terry Turner, and I'm a local planner, floodplain manager, and hazard mitigation specialist in one of the oldest cities in the South, Augusta, Georgia. In my position, I've seen the best of times and, unfortunately, the worst of times when it comes to operational coordination within a community, to community resiliency, and to long-term vulnerability. I'd like to take just a minute to tell you where we've come from in Augusta, where we've been as a community, and where we are headed in the future. Augusta was once a thriving metropolitan community. From its early days as an industrial mecca during the cotton boom to more modern advances such as our vibrant medical community, the military presence at Fort Gordon, and the Masters Golf Tournament, which is held at the pinnacle of the golf season each and every year. With all of that, it seemed that Augusta had it all. But unfortunately, during the 60s, flight to the burbs by the majority of the city's white and money-laden populace contributed to severe overall population losses and deepening financial problems for the city. It created what we refer to locally as a crisis climate for the entire area. Additionally, the overall county experienced considerable racial strife, much of it related to the belief that the city leaders were resisting efforts to provide full representation of blacks who were at that time the new majority. They were not being represented well in elected office, or at least that was their belief. The crisis climate was fed by a widespread perception that the local governments, both the city and the county governments, were unable to address the problems of the community adequately or effectively. This continuing conflict over distribution of power polarized the city by race and was aggravated by what most believe was a totally unresponsive government at the time. With hopes of bringing people and businesses back into the city's jurisdiction, multiple annexation attempts failed, some quite noticeably and quite miserably. In the mid-1990s, consolidation was turned to again as the next salvation for the city and county. And finally, in late 1995, consolidation finally passed. So now we have a newly consolidated government, but unfortunately it had different urban and suburban services, with most of the service providers being in the urban corridor and most of the growth happening in the outlying suburban areas, as many metropolitan areas find is what happens after consolidation. Unfortunately, the mistrust that plagued the city and county prior to consolidation carried over into the new government, and many departments were proprietary, and communication was at an all-time low, if not downright non-existent at times. So the challenge was monumental. How do we get our citizens to talk to one another, and how do we get them to have any trust in the current government? The Planning Commission, which had been consolidated many, many years before the city and county governments consolidated, led the drive in facilitating communication and cooperation throughout the new government and throughout the region as a whole. Over the last 15-plus years, collaborations and partnerships were formed by developing groups composed of city leaders, city departments, community stakeholders, and citizen activists to do everything from review ordinance changes to write and review our hazard mitigation plan, a plan that because of all the stakeholder involvement, which was truly extensive, this plan reflects the city's hazards and the city's capabilities for dealing with those same hazards. Once we had the players at the table and they were actually talking to one another, it was time to implement what I call the process. Now, the process aimed at making our community more resilient so that we didn't have to go through the many downturns we had faced in previous years. This was especially important in our propensity to disasters. It didn't take us long to figure out that we had little or no chance of a sustainable economy without disaster-resilient homes and disaster-resilient places to work. Again, the Planning Commission led the charge to promote community resilience by providing the framework for a disaster-resilient community. Buyout programs were instituted for the purchase of repetitively flooded homes and businesses. The flood buyout program also worked with our local land bank to accept donations of repetitively flooded homes and businesses, thus making those donations tax deductible. Partnerships were formed with the Central Savannah Land Trust to manage the considerable influx of donated properties, especially the large open space properties that were so valuable for flood storage and riparian buffers. Partnerships were also formed with the Finnessy Swamp Nature Park to establish and promote a wetlands bank where wetlands credits could be purchased. Increased community participation was facilitated in other areas as well, such as in our comprehensive plan update, our flood map updates, and those are just a few of the areas. We have been extremely blessed with an active community and with their participation in our governmental process. So long-term vulnerability reduction was the ultimate goal. It's my opinion that no one ever totally reaches that lofty goal, especially if the community is doing its job well, because there are always more challenges to meet and bigger and better mountains of attainment to climb. Augusta's made monumental strides toward long-term vulnerability reduction over recent years, however. Ordinance and regulations have been changed to combat our propensity to disasters, and they have worked so well that in recent years, flooding as a natural disaster has fallen from the community's number one risk to a resounding number two in the most recent update of our hazard mitigation plan. The consolidated government is more financially stable than it was prior to consolidation. The community is much more resilient than it was prior to consolidation. Hazards are now identified and dealt with given the limited resources of our community, which is still overall suffering from urban sprawl, and at times, as hard as we try not to have it happen, continuing racial conflict. But a new interest is being taken in moving back into the central city. A sustainability initiative backed by a new, bright, and young sustainability development manager is currently underway. Revitalization projects are taking place in many of the city's older downtown neighborhoods. The successes of promoting leadership, partnerships, and fostering collaboration among our community leaders, our community stakeholders, and our community citizens is paying off and reaping huge, huge dividends within our community. People are talking. They're communicating on how to work together to make their community and their surroundings a better place to live and a better place to work. They are becoming a more resilient community, together, hand in hand, doing the job that needs to be done. Quite frankly, nobody could be more proud of the efforts of our community than I am. As a city's floodplain manager, hazard mitigation specialist, and development administrator, I don't think that resilience just falls into your lap. It's the concerted efforts of a lot of somebodies doing a lot of some things right. It involves people with vision, with stamina, and with purpose. It involves leadership, good management, sustainability, and the courage to act in the community's best interest. I think we found that win-win combination here in Augusta, Georgia. As Augusta moves forward on the path of community resiliency, the lessons of the past have provided some of the successes we are enjoying today, and they will also ultimately pave the way for tomorrow's resounding triumphs in terms of sustainability and long-term vulnerability reduction. So, how does Augusta fit into the Resilient Neighbors Network framework? Well, as part of the network, I get to share Augusta's successes with other communities such as mine. I get to share them in events such as today. But, you know, there's communities all over the United States that are struggling to make themselves sustainable and resilient. And the network provides that opportunity for that collaboration and that partnership. And sometimes those communities are dealing with overwhelming odds. We, too, here in Augusta, have dealt with those same overwhelming odds, and we get to share that with these communities. But more importantly, I don't know it all, and neither does my community. So I get to learn from successful communities all over the United States on how they've overcome the hurdles they have faced in the past and how they are running for a victorious finish line in the future. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much to both of you. Let me get this my control back here. And we're very glad that both the resilient participants in the Resilience Neighbor Network and NHMA is continuing to focus on mitigation. As we all know, the focus kind of shifted after 9/11, but it's obviously still very important. Okay, we are going to proceed to our Q&A. And if you have a question or a comment, you're going to type in the Q&A box, please not in the chat box, and please address your question or comment to the host. And then I will, we basically take the questions or comments in order. I'll read them out loud, and our guests will respond over the bridge. Please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic. And if you can't address your question or comment to one of the panelists, please do so. We are ready to begin now, so please enter your comment or question at any time. And while we're waiting for folks to kind of get their thoughts together, I'd like to ask Alessandra, the vision for the Resilient Neighbor Network, are you going to pilot it for a year or so and then seek to expand it after that, or what is your approach there?
Thank you for asking. We pulled together the pilot communities to design the communications plan and also to talk about really a three-year plan for some of the types of activities that the network and the network communities could engage in. And so we will look over the next 3 years to expand the network and also to engage in various pilot projects, some of which will engage the network as a whole, and others are focused on particular communities within the network, but with feedback loops back to the broader network. And so some of what the network and the network participants are able to do is going to be dependent on funding. However, regardless of funding, the basic levels of communication and interaction can certainly be maintained. And so I'll give maybe two examples. We have some communities right now that are interested in looking at the intersection between mitigation planning and adaptation planning and have applied to participate in the Climate Solutions University, again, with that feedback loop to the other communities as they go through that process. We also have one community which is working with the Corps as part of the Silver Jacket Initiative to look at ways to make some of the data that the Corps is generating through Silver Jackets more readily useful to the community as a whole and provide that feedback. And that community will also work with the other communities in the Resilient Neighbors Network. And so it'll be that combination of those individual projects at the local level as different communities engage in different efforts and are able to capitalize on the expertise and experiences of the other communities, as well as some initiatives and tools that we may look to develop together as a network.
And did you all get some grant funding to help with this? Or?
We had an initial grant to help pull the communities together, which came from FEMA for the preliminary discussions. And then we've had conversations with other groups about ways to continue funding, for example, an annual meeting or the development of what we might call a toolkit, different components that are helpful to all the communities. And finally, we have had a great deal of mapping services very generously donated to us so that the communities are all able to work together around some GIS projects that will help with the data that they have available and how they can use it in their efforts.
Very good. And I have a question from Ava Jean that probably follows right on what you just mentioned in terms of the toolkit. She asks, how do you plan to share the tangible demonstrations of success regarding resilient neighborhoods as measurable milestones are met? I believe these successes are important to the entire country.
Absolutely. And there are a few mechanisms for that. One is certainly through presentations such as the one today, where either NHMA or some of the communities may talk about their efforts. And what we have been doing as we have done presentations relating to the Resilient Neighbors Network is we've always done them in partnership with at least one of the communities so that they could speak directly to their efforts. And we also will look to disseminate results through case studies, through community profiles, and other mechanisms through NHMA's broad network of partners, and as well as, of course, using social media and the internet and other mechanisms that might present themselves in the future. And finally, we are actually going to be working with Jacksonville State on an academic evaluation of the results as well, so that we can try to make sure that this process and this project is really yielding the results that we'd like it to.
Very good. I have a sneaking suspicion who you are working with at Jacksonville State. I've got a question for Terry, quick one, from Isabel McCurdy. She says, now that what is the number one hazard that you have now since the flooding has dropped to number two?
Well, our stakeholders committee decided to actually look at it very broadly, and so wind-related events. And that could be winds from hurricanes. We're 2 hours from the coast here. That could be winds from tropical storms. That could be tornadic winds. So wind-related events became our number one hazard. And like I said, flood had been number one for a number of years and moved to number two almost unanimously. But that's because of a lot of the efforts that the community and the community stakeholders have taken to combat that as a natural event within our community.
Very interesting. Okay, I have a question from Abel who asks, and I guess we'll go back to Alessandra on this one. How difficult is it to keep sustainability of the program and its participants during startup and the first year?
Good question. There are a lot of challenges, I think, just as far as how busy individuals are and lack of resources. I think that being able to meet in person and have an entire day of a facilitated discussion between the communities, I think that was tremendously helpful because it built some of those personal relationships among the community representatives that go beyond the network, so that there is now some of that informal interaction going as well. We've asked communities to designate secondary representatives so that we can try to maintain involvement with at least, you know, one individual or more in the community as we do our monthly get-togethers and whatnot. But as our communities are impacted by hazards that they face or other events, certainly their ability to participate waxes and wanes. So far, I think the value of the interactions and what they're getting out of it is helping to keep Resilient Neighbors Network going, and we hope that that will continue in the future. But that is something that we are going to need to continue to look at, is to make sure that there is essentially a return on investment for the time that these folks are putting in when they really don't have that much of it to spare.
And a little follow-up question from Isabel McCurdy. She was asking, how often do these communities meet? I guess you said monthly. And how many are there in each?
We are holding a monthly conference call with all of the communities. And then in addition to that, we have much more frequent interactions both among all the communities and in between some of the communities around different issues that arise. We've also been able to have several of the advisory team members, depending upon their own travels and where they're located, actually visit with some of the communities when they've been in the neighborhood, and some of the communities have also been able to visit with each other. So there is a great deal of informal interaction going on, which we think very much speaks to the need for something like Resilient Neighbors Network. But right now our formal mechanism is the conference calls, and we are seeking funding to try to pay travel to bring all of the communities together again next year, and potentially, you know, as we look to expand, to be able to have that meeting, because it seems to make a big difference to really have at least that minimal face-to-face interaction.
Very good. Question from Ava Jean for Terry. And she asks, how did Augusta get citizens from all walks of life involved? How do you expand the involvement and keep the community aware of progress?
I'm going to make this sound very easy, because as it turned out, it really, really was. We looked at our planning process from 5 years ago with our hazard mitigation plan. We looked at our planning process from our flood hazard mitigation plan. We looked at our planning process from our comprehensive plan. So things where we had to have community engagement. We also looked at who was being involved in things like ordinance amendments, development document amendments along the way. And we focused on those people, and then tried to also identify groups within the community that we knew needed to be at the table. And sometimes that involves having to make a few phone calls and asking around, because not always is the president or the executive director or the CEO of any particular organization going to be the one you want at the table. They're too busy, and it's hard for them to engage. But there's always someone within that group that is the workhorse. And if you can identify those people and bring them to the table, it's amazing what you can get done. We kept our last process that we did with this group was our hazard mitigation plan update, and we kept them engaged all through the process. And I think part of the success of that was making sure that we articulated to them in the very beginning that they weren't there to meet a line item on a piece of paper for a grant. They weren't there to impress the reporters, but that their contribution was meaningful and significant. And so we were able to keep them engaged all through the process. We actually did our hazard mitigation plan update in somewhat of a record setting pace, and the success was directly related to them getting engaged, staying engaged, and making sure that their voices were heard all throughout the process. I was, like I said in my presentation, I was extremely proud of them, not only during that, but in other things we've done. It really is starting to tell the tale here in Augusta, and we're seeing the successes from it. We are definitely able to put our finger on it and mark it as a success, mark it as a win in the win column, and then able to say to other communities in the network, okay, this is how we did it, may not be work exactly right for you, but this is how we did it. And then they're able to take our success, mold it to fit their community, and replicate what we've done. And I think that's another important message that I need to get out to. It has to be unique to your community. This is not a sustainability and resiliency is not a cookie cutter type project. It's not a one-size-fits-all. You really have to know your community, know your community's needs, know your community's vulnerabilities, know their ultimate goals in relation to those vulnerabilities, and then be able to mold your program around it.
I imagine there was a little leadership involved as well. Sounds great. Alessandra, I want to ask you a little bit more about the NHMA part. Definitely got the, from your presentation, the idea of the multidisciplinary nature of folks involved in mitigation in one way or another. And you did mention, I believe, the nexus with the climate adaptation. Do you have members from that community? Could you explain a little bit more about, how those two areas work together?
Absolutely. And I gave that as one example. So let me back up for a second and maybe just briefly mention some of the efforts of our committees, because a lot of our committees are sort of built around those areas of intersection. And so one would be our mitigation planning committee, which is currently about to release a white paper looking at ways to improve hazard mitigation planning, including elements such as broader stakeholder engagement, better coordination with other types of planning efforts, such as comprehensive planning, taking that long-range view that takes into account potential future conditions, not just current, so that we aren't designing mitigation projects around what older data tells us are our risks, but are actually being proactive. And one of our communities, Charlotte Mecklenburg, is an excellent example of a community that has done that work, where they have looked at even mapping potential future floodplain conditions. And then we also have our Disaster Resilient Communities Committee, which is really the committee that has housed the Resilient Neighbors Network and has had Resilient Neighbors Network as a goal. I mentioned the interaction with adaptation. That is something that has come up a lot recently. We do have members who are interested in looking at changing conditions, regardless of the reasons for those changing conditions, and they are simply interested in figuring out how to address what they are seeing changing in their communities. And as there is this discussion that seems to be emerging about things like adaptation planning, it's simply one area where there really is clearly a lot of intersection in terms of risk reduction efforts, particularly with bringing in that longer-term perspective of what a community might face. Another area where we've looked for intersections in a community that we've engaged with is the broader sustainability or green community, because there, again, there are a lot of areas of intersection, and some of our communities, such as Tulsa, have been incredibly active in that space in building that bridge, because true sustainability, in our opinion, has to take into account the hazard environment, the natural environment, and not go beyond just energy efficiency, but really look at that wide range of conditions. And finally, we also spend a lot of time speaking about and working on issues relating to land use zoning building codes, really focusing on the concept of safe and sustainable development, that as communities develop or change, that the natural environment be taken into account to reduce potential future losses and misery, and to have that conversation in a positive way, working with the development community to find ways to still have the economic benefits to communities of growth and other related benefits coupled with keeping the safety element and the reduction of human misery and losses really in mind. And so those are just a few examples. I would say that if you visit the NHMA website, we have a section that has presentations and publications, and that would give a good feel for some of the different areas that we have gotten engaged in, and you can find a lot of information there, I think, that would give a better feel.
Very good. Without going into specifics, do you all publish your membership or not?
We have not published a membership list. We've explored the possibility of a membership directory to make it easier for members to contact each other and interact with each other. And we've been looking at different ways to have discussion among members beyond the meetings, workshops, and the listserv. But that is something that we're still trying to find the best way to handle. We've run, you know, we have a decent feel in terms of statistics as far as we have actually pretty good coverage across the hazards, across the country, and as far as a lot of those kind of primary background professions. So we try to get a feel for that as much as we can.
Yeah, the reason I asked is we have a question from Ray Pena who wants to know if Atlanta, presumably Atlanta, Georgia, is active in NHMA. So you might answer him privately, perhaps.
Well, off the top of my head, I can think of at least 5 or 6 members in that area.
Okay.
Not an exact number, but certainly we have representation from within Atlanta and within Georgia.
Yeah. So, Ray, you may want to just, you know, ask your contacts there if they're involved. And if they're not, you know, send them the links to the information. Okay. I'm going to take this next question from Abel back at Terry. And if you can adapt this to your experience there in Augusta, Terry, please do. He's asking, is there much involvement from schools, scout groups, et cetera, that is younger community members, and is there outreach material available to generate interest from these younger community members? Thank you.
We've been really fortunate here in Augusta that through our land trust and especially through our nature park, we've been able to engage the school-aged children both in educational opportunities such as, you know, tours and that sort of thing, but also in projects as well. We do have the Finisee Swamp Nature Park. It also has an educational facility as part of their buildings and their facilities. And so they engage the younger population as well. And then there are a group of us, either through the land trust, through the nature park, myself, others here in the government, that do not hesitate when invited to go out into the community and speak to not only the school-aged children, but to neighborhood associations, to realty companies, to banks, to insurance companies, because the more we get the word out there, the more engaged our public becomes. And so we've had great successes in that as well. And we have Earth Day festivities. We have tables and booths and that sort of thing set up at different festivals through the year. And so we are constantly engaging our community in what we're doing. And the need for them to be involved as well.
Great. And if I may pile on to that question, Alessandra, is NHMA making any efforts to connect with either the FEMA's higher education program or maybe more general efforts in terms of how this, well, you're writing a textbook, I guess. Hopefully it'll be used in some of these higher education programs. But is NHMA looking at that, this education at that level as critical, you know, as we go forward?
I think we absolutely feel that it is critical to have education regarding hazard mitigation in the various emergency management programs and a lot of the other disciplines that end up touching upon mitigation. We have not been heavily engaged with FEMA's higher education, however. That is something that I think we would like to do. We do have an education committee which has looked really at two things. One is the creation and dissemination of materials that are really sort of more to a broader audience, but the other is also to try to get a feel for the types of mitigation-related courses and curriculum that are available. We partner with a lot of universities and research centers, and we are aware that a lot of them are beginning to undertake efforts to offer related coursework. And so we have been supportive as we can. I've guest lectured half a dozen times in the past 2 years. Our president, Ed Thomas, has as well, as have others of our board members. And so we try to make ourselves available as well as making our materials and publications available. I would also say in terms of partnerships within other areas in FEMA, we have been having conversations with folks in recovery around the ways in which the Resilient Neighbors Network communities can be of help to each other should one of them experience a disaster, and also potentially of help to other peers in perhaps similar communities. And we are about to have a call with the Preparedness Directorate to, again, look for ways to link, because as I mentioned before, a lot of the Resilient Neighbors Network communities are also very active in promoting preparedness among their citizens.
I want to, speaking of FEMA, I want to touch back on that. You mentioned, I believe, briefly, the mitigation framework document. Last I knew, there was a draft out on that last spring, and I don't mean to blindside you here, but is there anything you can tell us? Did you all comment on that? Do we know what the status of that is?
We did comment, and actually were fortunate enough to have some NHMA representatives on the stakeholder team that was able to help with some of that work. It is my understanding from conversations recently with folks at FEMA that it has cleared the interagency review and is now at the White House. I don't really know when we expect to see a final framework. Terry was involved with that to some extent, and she may actually know.
Terry, anything to add?
Yeah, Alessandra's correct. It's at the White House. I don't think it's come out for final publication yet. And we actually had two NHMA members that were part of the mitigation framework. The next thing we will see once the White House releases this, the next thing we will see out of probably a modified committee of those folks will be an implementation strategy. So that's the next thing you want to be watching for is that.
Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye out for all of this. We're going to wrap it up just a couple of minutes early today, and because we're going to take an opportunity to for those that are interested to do a little demo on the survey that we're conducting. But first, before we get to that, I just want to, on behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all the participants today, to thank very much to both of you for sharing the information. And special thanks to Ann Patton, who helped us prepare the program. We wish you much success with the RNN and NHMA in the future. Thank you. Okay, and before everyone else goes, there we go. We do ask you to take a moment to do this relevance and enter any additional comments you may have. And again, also, if you would like to see our feedback survey, you can stick around for a minute or two. Now, when you do exit today, the survey will come up in your browser. And if you haven't filled it out already, we encourage you to participate. You could win an iPad for you or your designated organization if you complete it by October 15th. And for those of you who have already completed it, We've had quite a good response so far. We thank you very much. Now, a few announcements to go over. I would like to take this opportunity to welcome two new EIIP partners today. We have the Northwest Tennessee Disaster Services, which is a humanitarian organization led by volunteers that provides relief to victims of disasters and helps people prevent, prepare for, and respond to emergencies. And this organization is represented by their CEO, Rob Adcock. Also, the Jefferson County, Colorado School Systems Emergency Management Program at Warren Tech is represented by the program's instructor, Chris Mayard. I apologize if I mispronounce your name. But we hope to feature this. It's a high school level class, but they actually get college credit for doing it. We hope to feature